Good to be back. First sermon of the year. It's not necessarily a New Year's sermon. It could be. Think about it. If we talk about this subject and think about it for a minute, it would be good to think about starting off the year, thinking about the subject of love, of which the New Testament and which Jesus had a lot to say. And there were a lot of passages that we could turn to. I thought that John 15 there, in that section that Bruce read just a moment ago, was good. And I actually picked out just a couple of passages to start off with. And that was verses 9 and 10. And I call your attention to those once again. As the Father hath loved me, so have I loved you. Continue you in my love. If you keep my commandments, you shall abide in my love, even as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. I'm using the King James this morning because King James has oftentimes has the word love, but it has a different word that you don't find in newer translations, and that is the word charity. That's because of the way that the translation was derived. They had different committees in different places, and they all acted independent of each other, but they all acted as a group together. And so when they translated a word, they tried to be consistent in translating that word. So they would translate the word as love, one committee would. But the other committee translated the word as charity. And then when they got together, they put them all together and changed very little, and they didn't change that. And I have to admit, for a long time, I thought that charity just didn't seem to work in this. But then I realized later on that I thought that the word charity really was perhaps even a better word than love. I'll explain that in just a little bit. There are many instances of love found in the New Testament. We can't look at all of them. That's just an impossibility. All of them at one time. Can't look at all of them. But we're going to look at some. And we're going to look at something that I think is familiar to all of us. But our text shows that Jesus possessed a love that he hoped would be copied by his disciples. By learning how Jesus loved, we will know how we are to love. And there are other things that are said in the scriptures about love that will help us as well. Now, as a word of explanation, let's understand that in some respects what the world and worldly religions consider love to be is not necessarily the love taught in the New Testament. I think that becomes painfully obvious in a lot of cases. There are people that actually think that love has to have some kind of an emotional demonstration with it. Whether that's hugging or kissing or tears, whatever it is, you know, something that's emotional in nature. And I think, again, you know, that presents a problem. Yes, love can have those things. It does have an emotional element to it. I'm not saying that. But to think that that has to have that, I think is saying just a little bit too much. So we need to keep that in mind throughout any study on the subject of love. Now, our first point that we're going to look at here is that the love of Jesus is best expressed by what he described, and also by whom Jesus loved. The very first thing that I want us to look at, and it's not necessarily the first thing that was ever said, but you go to Matthew chapter 7. We're going to look at Matthew chapter 7. And he says something here in Matthew chapter 7. We're going to look at verses 17 through 20. And this is just a really good thing. You know, love, it's known by its fruit. And what it says here is that even so every good tree bringeth forth good fruit, but a corrupt tree bringeth forth evil fruit. A good tree cannot bring forth evil fruit, neither can a corrupt tree bring forth good fruit. Every tree that bringeth not forth good fruit is hewn down and cast into the fire. Now, on another occasion in Matthew chapter 12, Jesus uses this same kind of terminology in verse 33, where he says, either make the tree good and his fruit good, or else make the tree corrupt and his fruit corrupt, for the tree is known by his fruit. Love is going to be known by the fruit that's born out of love. And whatever the fruit is, if it's good, the tree's good. If the fruit is bad, then the tree is bad. So yes, it does matter about the demonstrations or the manifestations of love. It proves whether the tree, that would be you or me, are exactly what we say that we are or what we should be. And Bruce read also in John chapter 15 another real good point for us to consider. And that is, in verse 13, greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. That's greater love. There isn't a greater love. So now, if we think about what Jesus said here in Matthew chapter 7, verses 17 to 20, and the other one in Matthew 12, then if this is great love, then it's great fruit. If it's great fruit, it's great love. What is that? Well, a man would lay down his life for his friends. So we see the idea here of sacrifice. Yeah, we see the idea of sacrifice here. And would we begin to see this idea of charity? Think about the word charity for a moment. In our English word, charity. Our English word, charity, we would associate, we'd probably say, first off, well, charity, you know, it's a good deed. And I think that's always what charity's been associated with. A good deed. But not just necessarily a good deed. You know, charity is really giving something. Now, I'm afraid sometimes we think of charity being always in the line of money given to some organization or for some worthy cause. And indeed, that is charity. I'm not saying it's not. But it goes in other ways, doesn't it? Sometimes it's not just giving money, writing a check, you know, or handing over a 5, 10, 20, or 100, whatever it is. Sometimes charity can be giving something intangible. A gift. Give someone something. I had a shotgun that a man that we always called Grandpa, but he really wasn't Grandpa. My grandfather lived in England, died before I was born, so he was kind of a surrogate grandfather to my sister and I. And he had this old shotgun made in 1930. And his widow gave it to my dad. My dad had that thing for years. The only shotgun in the house. He bought another shotgun. The one he had was a 20-gauge single action. And he bought another shotgun, bigger, 12-gauge. And he gave me the 20-gauge to use when I was about 12. I had it until last week. I always told myself that I would give it to my oldest grandson when I thought he was old enough to at least have a gun. It's up to his dad to show him how to use it and all that. So we took it with us. Case and all, I've no use for a case if I don't have a gun, do I? I gave Hayden, Buck, as we call him, that shotgun. And it's just an old gun. But I told him the whole story. And he knows where it all came from and what it means. Whether he ever shoots that thing or not, I don't know. It's all right if you use a small enough load in it, I guess. But that was a gift. In a gift like that, or any other kind of gift, where you give something to someone that has whatever the value might be, real or imagined, or sympathetic, whatever it is. When you give some, you don't really expect something in exchange. You're not, it's not a quid pro quo kind of thing. That's charity. That works if you're giving a check to an organization or if you're giving a gift to someone, like a family heirloom. You don't expect it coming back. Now what Jesus had to say here, greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. If you lay down your life, you're not going to get anything coming back. That's charity, isn't it? Sure. That would be the ultimate act of charity. Or love. So great love, great fruit, yes. And then when we consider Jesus and think about those that Jesus loved, I think we can learn a real lesson here. And where I'd like for us to start with Luke chapter 6. In Luke chapter 6, and we'll look at verse 27 and 35. Luke chapter 6, verses 27 and 35. I say unto you which hear, love your enemies, do good to them which hate you. Verse 35, love your enemies and do good and lend, hoping for nothing. And your reward shall be great, and you shall be the children of the highest, and he is kind unto the unthankful and to the evil. So you love your enemies. Now the reward you get is not going to come in this lifetime, of course, there. God will notice this. There's where your reward will be with God, not with your enemies. Your enemies will think you to be a fool if you show love toward them. But God expects you to do that. And wouldn't we say that Jesus did that very thing himself? We find numerous occasions we can read of the events when all of those that despitefully used him said all these things about him, mistreated him, lied about him, betrayed him, everything. They were his enemies. I think they intended to be. But I don't think he looked at them as enemies. But he looked at them as some that he loved as well. I think the world expects retaliation. I worked at a place for 18 years that just about ran on retaliation. I mean both ways. From management, from the employees, they just looked for ways to retaliate one to the other. I thought, well, what do you expect, you know? It's run on worldly things. But the Christian is not supposed to do that kind of thing. We're supposed to love our enemies. If we love our enemies, we don't retaliate. And an enemy is there braced, waiting for some act of retaliation. But a Christian doesn't give that. And the world will probably be baffled. Might now look into it to see why and other things along that line. Think what this can open up, you see. Another thing about Jesus, when you consider him, and this was mentioned in the class this morning about Jesus when he was tempted there in Matthew chapter 4, verse 1 through 10. Three temptations come his way. Three times Jesus meets those temptations with, it is written. And he quotes from either Deuteronomy 8 or Deuteronomy 6 in each one of those occasions. Quotes from Deuteronomy. Someplace in the Scriptures. The Scriptures that they had at the time. All Old Testament Scriptures, I understand that. Sure, no problem. But what does this say? It says that whenever Jesus was in a hard place, being tempted by the devil himself, what does he do? He turns to the Scriptures for an answer. Does that not indicate, I know it indicates lots of things, but doesn't it also indicate his love for the Scriptures? That he turns to them, he trusts them, he knows where that's where the Father has delivered his will, even in the Old Testament. And that's where you would go to find answers, where God could offer some help. And he did find answers, and it did offer help. And in the end, because of his love for the Scriptures and going to them, he was able to do what? Be successful against the devil? Not too many years ago, it was this the temptation of Jesus. I honestly sometimes had a problem getting my head wrapped around it. And there were those that were saying, members of the church now, that were saying, well, Jesus used divine powers that you and I don't have to resist the devil. I thought, really? Where is this? I don't know where it's at. All I know is that Jesus, in resisting the devil, used something that you and I could use. He used the Scriptures. The power of God is in the Scriptures. The mind of God is in the Scriptures. What God wants us to do is revealed in the Scriptures. They will allow us to be successful, victorious over the devil. We can resist the devil and he will flee from us if we use Scriptures. Do you know them well enough? Do you love them well enough that you could answer when hard times come your way? Because you'll have to answer that. I have to answer that too. But it should be something that's foremost. And if we love the Scriptures, well, how much better we'll be prepared. Jesus was. We will be too. I also see where Jesus loved the church. I think in the modern denominational mind, they have so marginalized the church. I mean, it's to such an extent that it's almost an afterthought. You know, to marginalize something means to take it out of the main body of a text in a book and put it over here in the margin someplace where probably nobody will look. That's what they think when you marginalize something. And so they've taken the church out of the main part and they put it over here in the margin. They think, oh, nobody will notice it over here. If we never say anything about it, and if we do say something about it, we'll minimize everything about it. So we marginalize it and they think in some way or another that's kind of eliminated. And I'm thinking, why go to all that bother and everything? And what do you do about some of the things that are said there? Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25 always comes to mind when I meet someone who thinks that, the church just doesn't matter. That's it, you know. That's the whole thing. They don't say it in so few words. They use maybe several hundred words. And when they come down to it at the end, it's, the church doesn't matter. It's just nothing, you know. And I see a passage like this that says, first of all, husbands love your wives. It's a comparison thing that's going on here. But the comparisons are true. Husbands are supposed to love their wives. Well, what about the comparison? The comparison, equally true, is this. Even as Christ also loved the church. There's the comparison. What else does it say, though? He gave himself for it. It what? What's the antecedent of the pronoun it? The church. Even as he gave himself for the church. That's exactly what that means there. And so we have to ask ourselves, if indeed the church has been marginalized and minimized in so many people's minds, then Jesus died for something that's marginal, that ought to be minimized. And the folks that come along and say, well, the church really doesn't mean anything. Jesus died for not much. What's next? You know what's next, don't you? When you get to that point, you think, how further can we go? The next step is to say that Jesus died for nothing. Well, thankfully, a lot of religious people aren't willing to say that. But boy, they sure get right close to it. In Acts chapter 20 and verse 28, shed his blood for the church. Referring once again to the fact that Jesus loved the church enough that he died for it. I also think that Jesus loved the brethren. He loved his brethren. He hopes that we would love one another. As a matter of fact, in John chapter 13, verses 34 and 35, a new commandment I give unto you, that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this shall all men know that you are my disciples, if you have love one to another." Sounds simple enough, doesn't it? At this point in time, in the life and ministry of Jesus, did he have any disciples that were following him, intimate or otherwise? I mean by that, I mean the apostles or anyone else. Did he have anyone that might have been hard-headed? Did he have anyone that wasn't really listening? Did he have any disciples that were a disappointment? Did he have any of them that were not developing as fast as perhaps he would have wished? Did he have any of them that just completely fell? Did he? You know the answer, don't you? To all those questions. I know the answer too. Those are rhetorical questions. You know what the answer is. Yes. Yes, he did. And he loved them. Now what are we supposed to do when some brethren disappoint us? Or they fail, or they're not developing as fast as I think that they should. Sometimes they fall. Well, if Jesus loved them, I'm supposed to love them too. And it's kind of interesting sometimes to look back, and I think about children and grandchildren. Both of our children have told me that they see our grandchildren being treated differently than they were treated growing up. That, of course, is subjective. I think they're just remembering the things they want to remember and forgetting the things that they don't want to, that they want to forget. And I always respond and tell them, well, we should have had the grandchildren first and then we would have treated you better. Doesn't answer it, does it? But anyway, that's the best I can do. But you know, treating your children or your grandchildren, patience involved. Do your grandchildren or your children ever disappoint you or fail you, or they don't come along like you should? Any of your kids or grandchildren ever make bad choices? Mine have. Love them anyway, don't we? Now, I'm saying all this because despite what the Scripture's saying, despite what we know, sometimes we just write others off too fast. And that's not what Jesus wants to be done. Not when he said those words. Something to think about, isn't it? In Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 9, Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 9. It says here that we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he by the grace of God should taste death for every man. You know what that's all about. That's all about saving souls. Jesus loved the souls of men. And so we should do the same thing. To love the souls of men. Now turn, if you will, to 1 Corinthians chapter 12. We got to go there to kind of set things up just a little bit. I was talking in Bible class about how chapters and verses and things like that are kind of a new thing. And generally they're divided up, you know, accurately. But the transition from chapter 12 to chapter 13 I think it's kind of missed it just a little bit. I really think the end of chapter 12, verse 31, that the last half of that passage should be the first verse of chapter 13. Because chapter 12 is talking about spiritual gifts, and that the spiritual gifts had a good purpose and that they were valuable. That's not it. Now, all their fussing and dividing and having competition for these gifts, that was wrong. But the gifts themselves were given by God for a purpose. And so he discusses all this. Now he's going to change just a little bit. And he said, "And yet show I unto you a more excellent way." The American Standard Version, I think, has the most forceful or highest way of putting it. It's got the most excellent way. In other words, you know, this is top of the line. Now, you know what follows in chapter 13. If you've studied anything about the Scriptures at all, what follows in chapter 13, and everybody was, it's the chapter about the superiority, the greatness of love. And that's right. And that's what we're going to look at here. So now, realizing that, and it doesn't matter if this is at the end of chapter 12. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying it might be a little better if we include that in there, because then you say, "I show you unto you a more excellent way." Here it is now. And it starts then with what we call chapter 13, verse 1. "Though I speak with the tongue of men and of angels and have not charity." There's our word there. Now, throughout this chapter, that's the word that's used in the King James. "And have not charity, I become a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains, and have not charity, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, and have not charity, it profiteth me nothing. Charity suffereth long and is kind. Charity vaunteth not, charity envieth not. Charity vaunteth not itself, is not puffed up, does not behave itself unseemly, seeketh not her own, is not easily provoked, thinketh no evil, rejoiceth not in iniquity, but rejoiceth in the truth, beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, endureth all things. Charity never faileth. But whether there be prophecies, they shall fail. Whether there be tongues, they shall cease. Whether there be knowledge, it shall vanish away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part, but when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away. When I was a child, I spake as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know even as also I am known. And now abideth faith, hope, charity, these three. But the greatest of these is charity." Now the word that's translated as charity there is a word, agape. And it's rendered as charity, and I think that's the right idea. I've already mentioned that. And other places, it may be love. It's charity in 2 Peter chapter 1, where you find the Christian graces. It's charity there. But I got a couple quotes here. "This word speaks of a love which is awakened by a sense of value in an object, which causes one to prize it. It springs from an appreciation of the preciousness of an object." And the second quote, "We think of love as an emotion. However, the word used here is a word associated with an act of will and not of the emotion." Now, this is my quote. I think the fact that this is something that's commanded. Remember, in John chapter 13, verse 34 and 35, Jesus commanded love. And I think the fact that love is commanded, not just there but other places, that rules out love being only an emotional response. In other words, when the world thinks that that's the case, or when the religious people think that's the case, or when you're in a Bible class and all the Bible class wants to talk about is love in an emotional way every time they see it somewhere in the Bible, they've misunderstood the whole thing. They've missed the mark. I do not know how one commands an emotional reaction. I don't know how that you do that. If I were to meet Rudy somewhere and say, "Rudy, I command you to be sad," you'd think I'd lost my mind. How in the world could I command someone to be sad? How could I command someone to be happy? How could I command someone to be anything that's got an emotional base to it, or demands an emotional reaction? You can't do that. We're really fortunate ourselves if we're able to have any kind of control over our own emotional responses, let alone someone else's. So, I think the whole idea of this, it just rules out that it's only emotional. I understand that, yes, it is somewhat involved with the emotions. Of course it is. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying when we think that's all it is, we've really missed the mark. Now, I want to make some points here about what we just read in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. I'm not going to make it lengthy, just real brief on all these things, but I want us to think about the things that are said here. In verses 1 through 3, you notice the superiority of love or charity in those passages. It's greater than tongues, prophecy, revelations, knowledge, faith, sacrifice. Without love, all those things are nothing. So you might kind of say, I remember when I was in taking chemistry class in college. It's been so long ago, I almost forget why I was taking it. But anyway, I was taking chemistry class in college. And I learned sometimes that there are certain chemicals that are, you know, they're harmless. By themselves, there's nothing to them. But you take this one that's harmless, and you take this other that's harmless, and if you put the two of them together, whoo, there you go. And what it is that the one, I don't remember how you determine this, but one is said to be a catalyst. In other words, if it's introduced to the other, here we go, you know. And I mean the reaction is just, in some cases, incredible. It's like, you know, the whole thing of like taking something like diesel fuel. You know, you run a truck or a tractor or something on diesel fuel, buy it down here, buy it at this station right down here at the corner. And then you take anhydrous ammonium, anhydrous nitrate, excuse me, and that's fertilizer. Put it in your garden out there. You buy it, you know, hardware store. But you mix the two together in the right ratio, and you've got an explosive, but it's got to have a catalyst. It's got to have something to set it off. That would be a blasting cap or something else, or dynamite or something to set it off. And so, what do we have here? Well, we've got things like tongues and prophecy and revelations and knowledge and faith and sacrifice. And the catalyst is love that really makes those things what they ought to be. Now, that doesn't deprecate tongues or prophecy or all these other things, but it just illustrates that without love, they're really nothing. And so you start off there with the superiority of love, and you realize, well, it's so how valuable then is it where I come in? Just with me alone, without any of those other things, just me. And he keeps saying in there, I am nothing, I am nothing, I am nothing. That's an apostle who's saying that. Where do we fit in? Well, we certainly fit in someplace. And we are nothing without love as well. In verses 4 through 7, you find out something about love. It says that love suffers long. I remember being in Florida listening to Dee Bowman preach on love. And he said, you know, he said, folks, he said, sometimes we don't suffer long with each other. No argument there. But you know what else he said? He said, sometimes we don't even suffer short. I thought, ouch. Good way of putting it, isn't it? But suffering long is opposite of short suffering. In other words, you know, we need some patience. We need patience with certain circumstances, like we talked about, you know, that people don't develop as fast as we think they should, as fast as I think they should, really. Oh, yeah. And someone's put me in charge of being the judge of everyone. No, they haven't. Or maybe someone's failed on something or whatever the case. You know, there ought to be some patience with circumstances. I think sometimes we lose sight of that, but that's part of long-suffering. Love, it says, is kind. It's mellow. It's not harsh. It's not sour. It's not ill-natured. It envies not. Now, envy is resenting the good others enjoy, whatever that might be. Not only do you resent this, you don't want them to have whatever it is that brings them this good, and you're willing to go so far as to ensure that they don't have that. That's envy. That's different than jealousy. Envy is several notches above jealousy. Don't ever think that the jealousy and envy are the same thing. They're not. Love rejoices in the things where others rejoice. Love, it says, vaunts not itself. It doesn't brag or boast ostentatiously. Don't need to. You don't need to be like those who went in there and were going to give an offering into the treasury and they had it all prearranged. Now, when you see me come up there and I'm getting ready to throw my tithes over there into the box where it's being collected, when you see that, I want somebody to sound a trumpet. Everybody will turn around, look at that trumpet, and you know what they'll see? Well, they'll see me putting that in there. What an ostentatious show. Anybody that Jesus said gives his alms before men, you got all the reward you're going to get. But love doesn't do that. You don't have to brag about it or boast about it. We're not supposed to do that. Someone said one time, well, I'm unaware of any good acts being done out here by brethren for other brethren. I didn't know we were supposed to advertise them or publish them or go around tooting our own horn. I don't think we're supposed to do that. Vaunts not itself. Love is not puffed up. The word that's translated as puffed up, anywhere you find it in the Scriptures, is the same word that in the common everyday Greek language was used to describe that thing over at the blacksmith shop that they took and did this with, you know, to get the fire bigger at the blacksmith shop. You know what that thing was? That thing's called a bellows. That's right. And it's the same word as puffing up. Well, I can see that. It puffs up the fire. Yeah, but you know what a bellows is? It's a bag of air. What's it saying here? Love's not a bag of air. Think about that for a moment or two. It's not filled with its own importance. There ought to be some humility in love. Love does not behave unseemly. It's not disgraceful. It's mannerly, it's respectful, and it's decent. Love seeks not her own. It's not selfish. It's not concerned with our desires, but the wants and needs of others. Remember, it's charity. It's not easily provoked. Love doesn't go around with a chip on the shoulder. I think there's a big lesson to be learned there. Love's not easily irritated. Now, love thinks no evil, and you probably see more of a diverse rendering of this than anything else. It's a technical term. And it really means putting something down in a ledger, you know? You know the old ledgers where they would write things in there, a list, here's your name, this ledger page, that's yours, and you write things. You know, like debts and assets, you know, where you owe so much and you paid so much. You know, it's keeping a record. Love doesn't keep a record. But I think sometimes we keep a record. We keep a record on good or bad. Now, love doesn't do that kind of a thing. It doesn't keep a record of shortcomings, failures, wrongs, pluses, minuses. There's no record keeping. Love rejoices properly. This ought to go without saying. Evil and truth are incompatible. Who could rejoice in wrongdoing? Who could not rejoice in truth? Seems to be simple enough. And then another one. Love gives the benefit of doubt. What does it say? Beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, endureth all things. Gives the benefit of doubt. We're not talking about gullibility here. That's not it at all. You know, you're not supposed to just let the wool be pulled over your eyes. But surely we can give our brethren, the people that we love, a break. We always need to be looking for the best to result. When you get down to verses 8 through 13, it once again shows the superiority of love. But also it shows the durability of love when you get down to these passages. Long after everything else has faded from memory. Like what? Well, long after things like prophecy and tongues and knowledge, all those things given by the Spirit, and all things that were good and proper for the time. But the time passes and they're not needed anymore. But love, charity, well, that remains. The greatest of these, it says, is love. Even among things that do remain, things like faith and hope. These three, in addition to charity. But the greatest of these is charity. Take your songbooks, turn to the songs been selected. Appreciate your presence or your patience this morning and your listening. But Jesus said, if you love me, keep my commandments. John chapter 14, verse 15. If we really love Jesus, we'll manifest that love by keeping his commandments. We'll believe in him. He says, unless you believe in me, you will all likewise perish. We'll be willing to repent of our sins. He says, unless you repent, you will all likewise perish. We'll be willing to be baptized. He said, if you believe and are baptized, you will be saved. And this is the love of God also now. Not just Jesus, but it's in conjunction with the love of God that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not burdensome. They're not grievous. 1 John chapter 5 and verse 3. Love is not necessarily keeping the commandments. No. Keeping the commandments is a result of loving God. So we're motivated by love for God and Christ. And when we're motivated by love for God and Christ, the commandments are easy to follow. Would you follow them today? Is there a need to be obedient to the gospel of Jesus Christ? Or having done so and perhaps fallen by the wayside, to return once again to following those commandments? If we can assist you in doing that, we'd be happy to do so. If you're subject, why don't you come all together? We stand and sing.